Jewish business law, we'll call it, and we want to know the assumption that we're working with here is that there's a concept, as you all know, called jurisprudence, which is sort of like an international body of ideas that govern law. Every country has its own legal system, and insofar as we're part of that culture, the culture influences us in the way we think, and we're very used to cases like this that come up daily in terms of the. But again, our focus today is employers and employees. Okay, the rights and obligations and so forth. So the first question is, can I seek a job that will result in the dismissal of another employee? Okay, that's question number one. Just write yes or no.
Direct or indirect?
No, I'm not directly trying to dismiss him. I'm just applying for a job, but I know that if I get the job, they're going to have to dismiss someone else. You know, we're talking in a laissez-faire kind of, you know what I'm saying? That's all I'm saying. Number two. So again, just write yes or no. Don't spend too much time. You know, my son, when he took tests, my son is very brilliant. You know, he's doing his residency here. His challenge was that when he took tests, he always tried to outthink the questionnaire. And that was antithetical. He always came up with another jurée. What did he mean by asking me? Because he's trying to fool me. This, if you just give your initial response, then it's okay. All right. Question number two. If an employee has not yet started working, but has only reached an agreement to begin working at a later date, can I seek that job that, again, when I use the term dismissal, it's a funny word here, maybe you can cross out the word dismissal, but it's not really dismissal in the sense that they only reached an agreement, but there was no document signed or anything like that, he hasn't started working, so am I permitted to seek that job, okay, that will result in the fact that the first employee will not work for that company, for that firm. Okay, yes or no? Question number three. Here's a case. The first employee's present term, as he's already working as opposed to the previous case, will terminate on July 31st. Okay? Can I seek to be hired on August 1st if the first employee would otherwise have his contract extended for a further period of time? The only contract that exists now will terminate at the end of July. I'm applying for a job for August 1st. Okay? Now keep in mind that in this particular scenario, in case you had any questions about it, I want to make this clear up front, that first employee, again, whose contract will terminate at the end of July, has other sources of income. You know, we're not talking about some issue of poverty or so forth and so on that maybe the government would extend the special rights to him. And just wanted to clear that out of the way. So that's question number three.
And you're not looking at this job, you're going to take it for a lesser amount of money. We're talking about...
No, same amount of money. No, I'm not bargaining with anything, but I just want to know if I can apply for a job since his term of contract has terminated. Just give me a yes or no answer. Question number four. Is it permissible to lure an employee away from the employer? In other words, you want to get this guy on your team, on your firm, by offering more money or better conditions. That's question number four. Question number five. There's a gabbai in the synagogue. You know, he's in charge of arranging everything. And he says to a little boy, a very little boy, that if he collects all the prayer books and puts them back in the shelf, he'll give him a candy. Okay, that candy is worth less than a pruta. Well, you know, a pruta is the minimal amount of money that, in halachic terms, registers. And then, this gabbai neglects to give the child the candy. Has he violated any Torah prohibition? Okay, now I'm asking you again to shoot from the hip and just give me a yes or no answer.
If we say yes, do we have to know which one?
No, we're not going that far. Okay, number six. Here's the case. You arrive at the airport with a large bag, and you hire a porter to carry the bag and deposit it in a specific place. You know, tell him to put it down in place X, where you plan to join with him shortly, and you will pay the agreed upon fee. You were detained on the way to the meeting place. Okay, you got a business call, let's say. You know, somebody called you on your cell phone as you're, you know, running to pay this porter. And when you arrive, lo and behold, the porter is gone. We say in Hebrew, Hanar Einenu. He disappeared into thin air. Are you obligated, now please read this very carefully, are you obligated to search for the porter in order to pay his fee, the fee that you owe him, even if this would lead to your missing your flight and cause you to incur costly expenses? We have that? Clear? That was number six. Number seven. You hire a worker to work at a particular job for a set wage. No contract was signed, nor was any kinyan enacted. Now let me just explain what the word kinyan means, if any of you are not oriented. In halakha, in Jewish law, we have to make a formal binding act, which clinches the deal. Or perhaps a contract would substitute for that kinyan. But in this particular case, you hired someone for a job, you agreed upon his wages, but no kinyan was made. No contract was signed. The employee has begun his work, but now you realize that you want to drop that job. It's just not worth it for you. But you would like to assign that same worker to a different task. The new task is more difficult than the original one, and therefore the worker refuses. Can you just pay him the wages he has earned until that point? Let's say, for example, you pay him $10 a day. He did a half a day's work. Now you want to switch and give him a different job. The first job is just not worth it for you. The second job he doesn't want to take on. He says it's too complicated for him. It's too physically taxing for him. Can you just pay him five, which is the value that he deserves for that half a day of work, and tell him to pack his bags because he refuses to take on that job? So can you let him go? That was question number what?
Seven.
Number seven. Okay? Now how many people are writing their answers? Everybody writing answers here? Because at the end of the day, I want you to grade yourself, and hopefully everyone will get an A. But we're up to number eight. Okay then? You hired a painter. Okay? We're talking about someone to paint your house. And you hired him for a day's work at a certain price, and then just before the painter arrives, your wife says to you, or your husband says to you, I heard about a better painter. Does a better job, maybe he's more honest, whatever the reputation might be. So the painter arrives, just momentarily, and you inform him that you are no longer interested in his services. The painter claims that he gave up other employment opportunities, and it is now too late for him to hire himself out for the day. Are you required to pay his wages? Now please emphasize the last part of this question. Even though he will not be painting your home. In other words, you're sending him packing. That's it. You know, you want a different painter. He's more professional. He does special things. He does those paisley walls. You know what I'm saying? And this guy is going. But he says, look, you know, I came and I gave up other opportunities. Do I have to pay his wages for that we agreed upon, but he's not painting anything? Okay. Number nine. Now this one is most close to my heart, because I have this all the time. And I never seem to get the lesson straight, because what you have to do before you hire somebody, you got to decide how much you're going to pay them. Otherwise, you know, surprises around the corner. This happens to me in Israel a lot with cab drivers. You know, they, you know, in Hebrew we say lafil tamoneh. You know, get the meter going, and then he doesn't put the meter on, and then at the end, you know, he hits you with a bill, and you hit the ceiling. So what happened here? You call a plumber to make a repair, and upon completing the job, he hands you a bill which you consider exorbitant. Can anybody by show of hands ever relate to such a thing? Am I the only one who has undergone this experience? I don't know. So an argument ensues, and you pay him less than the amount that he requested, simply because he's not interested in wasting his time arguing with you. He might also not want to, he knows that you might give him a bad rep or something like that, so he takes the money and runs. Are you okay? Are you permitted to do such a thing? You decide his price is too high, I'm going to give him whatever I'm going to give him. That was number 9.
And he accepted it.
Well, again, I try to point out here that the reason why he accepts it is because simply he doesn't have time to argue with you. He's got better things to do with his time. He insists that his price is a fair price.
What were the prices agreed upon before?
They didn't agree upon a price. That's the tzara here. That's why I say that in this case, number 9, is very touches home. I never cease to have to learn this lesson. You ask in Hebrew, we say a hatzat mechir. Give me a hatzat mechir. Tell me exactly what the job is going to cost. Now, if you're a really honest guy, then later on you'll tell me, well, I didn't have to work that hard. I'll give a break on the price. Or if at some point you see that the estimate that you gave him was lower than what reflects the reality, so you say, look, would you agree to pay me more? I'm going to do this. I didn't realize it. But in this case, there was no agreement on a set price for the job. And finito, he presents you with a fait accompli. Here's the bill. And you jump out of your seat and say, what's going on? So, of course, you start fighting back and forth. I don't know if you've ever fought with a cab, but I unfortunately have. It's, in Israel, it's a little bit tricky. It can get dangerous. And at some point, the cab driver just... And I've had this. They just throw in the towels. Sometimes they'll even take your money and throw it back in the face. I don't know if you've seen that. They don't, because they insist that they're correct. So in this case, number 9, you decide that you have the fair price to pay him, and that's what he's going to get paid. Okay, number 10. This is an interesting question. Are there any people here in the audience who are in sort of managerial positions? Yeah? Okay. So for those of you who are managers, I want you to listen carefully to number 10. This is what we call a trap. You set a trap for your workers to test them. Not this kind of trap, because I'm not grading these papers. So I just want to make that clear from the upside. This is not a trap. Does everybody have that? You don't believe me. I see you don't believe me. Okay.
Question is there a reason to do the trap?
I'll tell you what the reason to do the trap.
If there have been instances where people are convinced that they're wrong, then that's a whole different story.
Oh, okay, excellent. You already read number 10, is that
yes.
it?
Yes.
Oh, okay, Jeff's a little bit ahead of me. I'm slow. And even though I typed this out, at all hours of the night last night, but he's already read this already. Okay, you're the manager of a company. Are you permitted to set a trap in order to test the integrity of the employees in your firm? Now, I couldn't come up with a trap in which you could test everyone in your firm. I came up with a smaller one. So that's why I say some of the employees in your firm. Maybe somebody could come up with a more brilliant trap that could really apply to all the workers in your firm. But I don't think this one will work for everyone because the word's going to get out, So here's the example I want to give. You invite an employee into your office for a friendly chat. And you had planned deliberately to leave a wallet on your desk, and it's quite clear that there's cash in the wallet. And you plan to step out of the office for X number of minutes and see what happens. Okay? Now, if you come back into the office, where we're doing number 10, which could be very relevant to anyone who is in a managerial position or in the future will be in a managerial position, you want to test their integrity. Now, I'm not going to go as far as to say you've got closed circuit television going on. That's really going far. But you're going to come back and see whether they bit into the bait, so to speak, and took some of the money. So you plan to leave a full wallet of money in an open drawer, leave the employee alone for several minutes, and see if he or she is tempted and cannot overcome that temptation to steal the money. Okay? Is that halakhically permissible? Is it permissible according to law? What would be your sense? Okay, so we're all lawyers here, so to speak. We have an intuitive sense of jurisprudence, and we want to give a yes or no answer to this question.
But is there something going on at your office that there's a reason? So there is a reason, rationale for
you. Okay, so maybe you want to add that to the question, that if there is, or, you know, that... Question number 11. You worked for firm A, and now you've moved on to firm B. While working at the first firm, you learned certain secrets of the profession. Are you permitted to reveal them and share them with your new employer? Okay? These are, when I say secrets, you're not stealing anything physical. Question number 12.
Hold on.
Yeah, sorry.
Because on that one, there's secrets of
the
profession.
Wait, don't give away the answer. Wait, are you know, we're all sworn to secrets.
Are they secrets of the profession, or are they secrets of your first employer?
Okay, good, good. Okay. We'll come back to that. Oh, you have an example? Go ahead.
Yeah, for example, client lists, customer lists. Mm. Those are not really, those are proprietary to your first employer.
Right, right. I don't mean something like that. I'm not talking about, I'm talking about lists of clients. What I'm talking about is, you know, how to succeed in this particular business. You know, now you're going to work for another firm, and you know all the ins and outs of the first firm. You know, it's some people are very careful about who they hire and who they fire because they're afraid that they've already learned the, you know, learned the business. You know what I'm saying?
Only, right? I'm assuming.
But there could be, but you could have secrets of the trade that are truly proprietary.
Okay. So those.
For example.
Right, okay. So we'll get back to that, believe me. Okay, question number, what are we up to, 12? Okay. Is everybody with me down there? This is a very long table, so I'm trying to sort of project my voice in both directions here. But the chairs are very comfortable. It's really a pleasure. I keep myself awake in these chairs. Okay. Here's an interesting question. I find this fascinating. You're an employee. You work from, let's say, 9 to 5. Does your commitment to your firm or your employer go beyond 9 to 5? Meaning, let's say you make decisions about your personal lifestyle. Does your manager or does your boss have any rights whatsoever to enter into that area? I give a few examples. Let's say you desire to take on a diet. I don't know if anybody here has heard of Atkins. In Canada, we don't know about that. All right. So for sure you never heard of Southridge. Anyway, there are certain diets in the United States that are known to be severe diets. I mean, basically Atkins means that you live on meat and sardines, you know, for the rest of your life. I wouldn't try it. It's very severe.
Yeah.
I have family members who are on Atkins, but it lasted for about a year. And then, as soon as they got off the diet, they got fat again. So we say in Hebrew, "Mahu chachamim." But that could also, you know, what did you gain by that? Or, for example, you want to take on additional employment. You don't have the permission to do so explicitly, but you're a free agent at the end of your working day. Now, that's why I emphasize you're going to work independently to make some extra money, or for another employee, another employer. And not if it's for your own, you know, if you're taking on overtime, that's a whole different story. Then, for sure, there's no. So that wouldn't. I wouldn't even ask that question. Is it clear? Question number 12. Now, moving on to page 2, I think. Question number 13. As an employee, may you use the property of your employer or the employer's firm? Now, when I say a firm, you know, there are different types of firms. There are privately owned firms, there are publicly owned firms. I'm not making any distinction. You know, even if the firm goes on the stock market and sells shares, I didn't mean to, you know, write any distinctions. In any event, for your own personal purposes. Now here, you know, even though it's a yes-no question, you know, I gave a few examples like using the company car or perhaps the telephone or the fax machine, the copy machine, and so forth. I think you might, this question I feel is a little bit tough to answer because you might want to think about different scenarios. You know, it's not all the same. You know, you can't come to the same conclusion about using a copy machine and using a company car. You know, so in a sense, the way I put it together here, I try to oversimplify. So just do the best you can, and if you want to write a little note to the professor, well, it depends on X, Y, or Z, I'll accept that. What?
It's a question of materiality.
Okay, materiality. I like that word, materiality. Okay, number 14. As an employee, may you take off time from work in order to pray for davening. Okay? Now here in Zeifman's, that's not an issue. I mean, I've seen the Siddurim all over the place. But, I'm talking about, your classical. And finally, 15. This one I find very, very interesting. You're a worker who gets paid per hour. And you're negotiating your wages with your future employer for a job that will begin in a month. Your employer offers you a deal. He says to you, look, I trust you. I want to lure you into this job to get you in. I'm willing to pay you in advance, but you have to move towards me as well. In other words, instead of paying you 100, I'll pay you 90. So you're willing to take 90 because he's paying you in advance. Oh, okay. You gave it away. That's not fair. Again, you didn't hear the introduction, but the introduction was, I want you to give it your intuitive sense of what you think the law would be in such a case. Okay? Fine. So those are the 15 questions. And now, I'm going to try to go through them one by one and present to you, in the light of Jewish law, what the answers are, and you'll grade yourself as we go through this. Right? Good? Any questions? Any comments? Okay. Question number one. And by the way, I don't pretend for one moment to have exhausted this topic of employee-employer rights and privileges and so forth. I mean, I just, we're just touching the very, very tip of the iceberg. I brought with me two sfarim. One is in Hebrew, one is in English. And I've worked very hard on trying to find the answers through these sfarim. You'll see also on page 2 that I have for you some source material, which you could, some of it maybe we'll have time to read together today. Others you'll have to read on your own for those who are interested in the real research of it. Let's go through the questions one by one. Can I seek a job that will result in the dismissal of another employee? I'm just out of curiosity, how many people said yes to this question? Oh, that's not bad. So the answer to this question is no. Okay, this is absolutely forbidden according to Jewish law, because in doing so, you are what's called goreim nezek. Goreim nezek means that if you cause someone to lose his job, you are causing him a financial loss. Now, it matters not how destitute he is or how wealthy he is. The halacha, the Jewish law, doesn't make that distinction. As long as he's taking a loss, in this case he's losing his job, then you caused him to lose the job. But what about the second question? In this case, the employee...
Before we leave the first question.
Yeah. Just that the first three questions form a unit, so... Maybe give me a moment just to close the puzzle here. In the second case, the employee has not yet started working. He's reached some sort of an agreement to begin working at a later date. So as opposed to the first case, which if the halacha sees it as if the employee who's already working has a kind of ownership, he has rights and privileges to his work, and I am now causing him to lose those privileges and rights. In the second case, he doesn't have those rights, but there's been an agreement that's reached. In other words, if things are left as they are, status quo, he'll have the job. Can I make a beeline for that job and present my candidacy? And then he's going to be bumped off. But again, he hasn't started working yet. What would be the answer to this question? Yes or no?
Yes.
How many people said yes? All right, that's good. The answer to this question is no. This also is prohibited according to Jewish law. Okay, we're doing great so far.
Yeah.
Now, what does the Jewish law say? Now, I'm going to give you the fancy Hebrew for it, Because this is a very fundamental concept in Jewish law, and then I'll try to explain it. I don't expect you to walk out of here remembering the Hebrew. This is called Ani Hamahapech Becharora. It's a sugi in Kiddush. In the olden days, what they used to do is they used to take dough, and they used to barbecue it on a fire. Some of it was perfect. You know, it came out toasty, and of course, that wasn't to be shared with anyone but the owner. But some of them got burnt. And what used to happen is that the poor people would come around looking for a charora. That's what the Gemara talks about. In my childhood, I don't know if you can relate to this because I don't know if they have beaches here in Toronto, but when we were kids, we used to go to the beach, and there were people who would go with a sifter on through the sand and try to see if they could find a watch or a ring or something that fell into the sand. You know, I mean, you'd have to work for like a month until you found something. But I guess they were poor people, and that's how they hoped to find something. So the Gemara says that our rabbis made a takana, a new injunction, that said, "Ani hamahapich b'charora." If this poor person. And again, it doesn't have to be a poor person. The Gemara only uses that to, you know, to make it realistic and common. Is on his way to find something. He's about to pick up something. You cannot make a lunge for that object and take it before him. And the Gemara, for example, applies this to the case of fishermen. A fisherman puts out his net to trap the fish. The fish haven't yet entered into his net. And this takana, this injunction, prohibits another fisherman from coming by and putting his net in order to precede him. What word am I looking for? In order to preempt him. Exactly. That's the word I was looking for. Thank you, David. To preempt him and catch the fish before they enter into his net. Once they enter into his net, we don't need the rabbis to make an injunction to steal the fish from the net once they're entrapped. Then the first fisherman has already made what we call a kinyan. Remember we spoke about before, a clincher, he owns it. And therefore I'd be stealing if I took those fish. But the fish haven't yet entered into his net. Here the Rabbanon, the rabbis, made a takanan injunction. This is what we call gezel midivrehem. Again, that's for a longer discussion. But if you were to try to preempt him and take the fish before they go into his net, that would be in violation of ani hamahapich b'charor. Therefore, if we come back to case number two, this employee is about to get a job. In fact, he's at the point where he's about to reach an agreement. He hasn't yet started working, because once he starts working, that's already a kinyan, and then there's nothing to talk about. That already fits into the first category, where you cause his dismissal. But here he hasn't started working yet, so he has no actual possession over his job. But nevertheless, he's about to reach an agreement. That's called ani hamahapich b'charor. For you to undermine him and take this away would be in violation of that takanat chachamim. Question number three. Now, in this question, the term of agreement with regard to the first employee ends at the end of July. I want to come and present my candidacy for a job that will begin on August 1st. Again, it doesn't have to be August 1st. I'm just giving you an example. So what's wrong with that? Yeah, but the answer is, I think everyone would have said that this is okay. I don't know if everyone said yes to this. I don't know. How many people said yes to number three? Okay, that's good. We're doing great today. So the answer is that this is absolutely forbidden according to Jewish law. And the reason for that is because the first employee would otherwise have presented himself, he's done such a great job until this time, to ask for an extension of his contract. Okay then? So if you know that he, the employer, is happy with this employee, and number two, the employee would like to shoot for an extension of his contract, once again, it comes under ani hamahapich b'charor. And that leads me to question number four. And this is luring people away. Okay, until now, whose rights and obligations are we talking about? The employee. Now we're going to talk about the employer. Right.
Before we go to, you said that the first three are one package. So the reality, my perspective is the reality of employees being replaced is that generally an employer will not replace an employee with another employee unless the first employee is not doing a terribly good job.
Or the second employee is better, superior.
Perhaps. But generally...
Or willing to work for less money.
Perhaps. But generally...
It's the same.
Right. But generally, an employer will not replace an employee unless they're not satisfied with the performance of the employee. Then they may wait to find a new employee before they replace the first.
Right.
But clearly the first employee is being replaced because they're not doing the job properly, their attitude is bad, whatever it is. So to what extent does that do these rules still apply
so that's
the employer is not happy with the employee in the first place?
So that, Larry, I think is going to be question number four. And I'll get right back to you. Question number four is if you're... Okay, wait, I'm sorry, I just can't... I have to answer this question because I think it really puts the four questions into a package, and that is, if you're an employer and you have second thoughts about this employee, you know, you're in a sense waiting for his term of contract to come to its end, then why not hire what we call today a headhunter to find someone who you think is going to be good for this job and lure him away from his job? Isn't that what goes on constantly in our society? Is there anything illegal about trying to, in a sense, steal, if you pardon the phrase, an employee from another job? Because you're not happy with the employee that you have now, why not replace him with someone else? Isn't it the right, the inalienable right, you know, by the Fifth Amendment, to go out and try to find another employee to replace this one? No, but you say, but this employee has a job. Yeah, every good man has a job, right? The good men are not out there unless somebody stabbed them in the back. But generally speaking, they're not out there to be taken. They're not floating, you know, the good ball players are not floating in the, in the free market there. So what do you do? Either you hire somebody to do the job for you, or you do it yourself. You give the guy a buzz. You say, oh, you're working for firm X. Yeah, what do they pay you? What are the work conditions like? I can double that, or whatever. Is that okay? How many people wrote yes to number four? Well, we're really doing fantastically today. And the answer is no. This is absolutely against Jewish law. You are not permitted to lure someone. And again, if any of you are working in headhunting firms, then you didn't want to hear what I had to say here, because, as we'll soon see in the sources, depending on how much time we have, this is forbidden. However, what do you do?
Why does halakha protect the first employer who's paying less than the market rate?
Oh, I don't know about less than the market rate, but if there's already an agreement, B, he's already working, then that employee-employer relation is already halakhically set into... Now, so what do you do? What do you do halakhically to avoid this? Is there any way that you can allure someone, that you can bring someone into your firm because you think he will add tremendously to your firm? So here it's very fascinating to me. The halakha makes the following distinction. There's direct and there's indirect, meaning to lunge for the jugular, that you can't do. But what you could do is, anybody know what I have in mind? How do you get this guy over to your team? Exactly, advertisement. And you could take that advertisement and literally put it down on his desk. The halakha does not confine you in any way with regard to advertising, as long as you don't make a direct plea to him. Because advertising is absolutely acceptable in halakha. But what you're going to have to do is, you're going to have to advertise a job with better conditions and a higher salary than the one that this guy's paid. In other words, if you're privy to that information, then you could go ahead actively and go into an advertising campaign in which you could try to allure him. He, that employee, may decide it's worth it for him to turn in his resignation and work for you. He may decide that it's not worth it. You cannot approach him directly, but you can advertise. Now I want to go back to your question.
So my question, the first three, because the questions are from the perspective of the employee that's seeking to be hired, I don't understand that, you know, the fisherman example. Because in the fisherman example, you're throwing your net in front of the other person. You're taking a fish that would have otherwise gone to the first fisherman. In this case, all you're doing is giving your resume in, and you're not making the decision on the existing employee.
But you're actively seeking out the job.
I'm looking for a job, but at the end of the day, I'm not the one making the decision whether to hire or fire me or fire the other.
Correct, person. But you're really causing that person to lose his shot at that job, which he's already... He's, you see, either he's already working, that was question
Here's
number one.
Resume, I'm around, and the potential employer decides, do I want the new guy or do I like the new guy?
Okay. You know what? I think after we finish, we can fight this out. But I frankly don't see anything different between that case and the case of the fish. All right, let's go on to case number 5, because I don't know, we have about 15 minutes and I want to at least figure out what grades we got here, you know, if anyone's willing to tell me. Okay, case number 5. So the gabbai doesn't give the candy to the child. The candy is worth less than a pruta. Has the gabbai, by not giving the candy to the child, has he violated any transgression?
No.
Yes.
How many people said no? Oh. Okay. How many people said yes? Okay. Good. He has violated 3 biblical transgressions by not giving this child his candy. And it's irrelevant whether the candy is worth a pruta or not worth a pruta. Because even though less than a pruta is not collectible in a court of law, you can't sue for it, but nevertheless, as far as the violation of the law, and we can talk about this at great length because it's fascinating how halakha works on two different levels, you have violated this. Now, you might ask the following question. He's a child. What rights does a child have in halakha? And the truth is that Jewish law protects the rights of children even in the monetary financial world. Once this child has been hired to do the job of cleaning up the sidurim and putting them on the shelves for one piece of candy, and by the way, you'll be shocked what you can get out of even an adult for one piece of candy. I have a few stories about that. Specifically, I don't know if you've seen these jelly bellies that they have. So my son up in Yucknam, that's in the north of Israel, gives out jelly bellies. You can't believe how many mitzvahs he gets people to do for jelly bellies. But
and
the child...
the whole lunch.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And, yeah, so that's as far as number 5 is concerned. So now I see we're picking up. Okay, now number 6. Okay, what's the answer to number 6? How many people said that in number 6... that the answer is yes. You have to take miss your flight and incur costly expenses. How many people said yes? Very good. We're doing great. The answer is yes. Okay? I don't care if you're missing your flight. I don't care if you're incurring costly expenses. You have to find that porter. And I'll tell you why. If you don't find that porter, you are in violation of 5 biblical commands. Now the law is that if somebody forces you to spend money, you'll need to spend money in order to avoid violating, transgressing a Torah prohibition, then you have to spend every last penny in your pocket, all your income. You have to sell the shirt off your back. However, for the sake of a mitzvah, of a positive command, you have to give up maximum 20% of your assets. Which of those 2 percentages you think would apply in this case? That's a trick question. Okay, it's the latter one, it's the 20% one. I'll tell you why. There are 2 types of prohibitions. There is what we call kumvase, where you actively put your hand into someone's pocket, and then there's shevialtase, where you're passive about it. In this case, you're not putting your hand into the porter's pocket and taking away the 20 bucks that you owe him. You're just simply not paying him. So your act of stealing is being implemented in a passive sort of way. A passive violation is considered in halakha like a mitzvah aseh. It has the same status as a positive command. And therefore, since you didn't go ahead and pay him, your violation of gzeilu would fall into the 20 percentile. Now, if missing your flight is going to cause you to lose 20% of your assets, then let it go. It doesn't mean you owe all the porter money. You know, you're going to be seeking this guy out for the rest of your life. I hope you took his name and his number down. But you don't have to take that in. But if it's up to 20%, that's 1/5 of your entire assets, miss your plane.
But if you
therefore, the answer to this question is pay the porter before the job in this case.
If you weren't detained.
Oh. If the whole situation changes, and that's why I told you that you got a phone call, if he flew the coop, you know, instead of giving you that 5 minutes that you agreed upon to wait for him, because he has other jobs that he wants to do, this porter gets paid by the moment, so he doesn't. If he, on the other hand, didn't live up to his side of the agreement, that's a whole different story. You still owe him the money. But you don't have to incur any loss. Question number 7. Okay? What do you say about this question? How many people said that you can pay him the wages that he earned until this point, cancel the deal, and then let him go? You answered yes? Okay. So here's what the answer is to this question. Again, we're going to run out of time here, and I'm very nervous. There's something called kipoel bata. What does that mean? From the time that you let this guy go, from that moment, until he gets himself another employment, you are responsible to pay his salary. But you don't have to pay his full salary. You have to pay him kipoel bata. And let me give you an example of what kipoel bata means. Let's say maybe I shouldn't use this word, a shrink, a psychiatrist. Okay. You're a psychiatrist and you take $500 an hour. What would you be willing to take if I were to tell you that your client's not coming in? What would you be willing to settle for? How much would you reduce your fee to give up that hour but do nothing? Just be idle. Anyone want to throw it at some? I mean, your guess is just as good as mine. We don't have any psychiatrists here.
Depends on the doctor here.
If my appointment book is full, then I would charge the same for a missed appointment.
Well, wouldn't you reduce it a little bit? I mean, you could read the paper, you could catch up on spend some time with your family. I mean, there's got to be some reduction. You follow me? But probably in the case of psychiatrists, it's going to be very low. If, on the other hand, you're a heavy worker, you know, it takes you a lot of energy to do what you do. You don't get paid that much per hour. So let's say you're, how do you say sabal in English? A schlepper, and you get paid $10 an hour. So to get that day off, you know, get the day off or so, you're willing to take 50% of that. You know, you reduce it by significantly. So it's going to shift from country to country, from society to society, but basically the fundamental principle is that you can't just fire this guy. You can't just decide you want to hire a different painter. He's got to seek employment elsewhere. You're responsible to pay him at least kipoel batel as an idle worker, subtracting, let's say, a certain percentage of his wage until he finds another job. Question number 8. Okay. Actually, I just answered question number 8. Question number... I skipped 7, I think. Which was the... I'm sorry. So give me a minute here. There's no contract was signed as an employee began his work. We realized that even if he... Right. Right, so the answer to number 7 is no. The answer to number 8 is... The answer is yes to number 8. But... with one proviso that you don't have to pay him the full amount, but rather you have to pay him kipoel bata, okay, as an idle worker. Okay, what about this plumber? Am I allowed to say, look, what are you charging me $150, you know, because I had one plugged up, stuffed up toilet, you know, I'll pay you $100. He doesn't want to fight with me, he knows the fee is $150, and he packs up and takes the $100 and he runs. What's the answer to that?
Wouldn't it depend if there's an established pay scale?
Correct. So the answer is that it's the burden of proof is upon you who hired this plumber to prove, to demonstrate that he's overcharging you. If he claims it's a fair price, then he's innocent until proven guilty. He's believed until you could go out into the market and prove it.
But the fact that he accepts it,
that's not enough, because that's not called a mechila. Mechila only operates when you have time to deal with it and you willingly offer what's called a mechila. In other words, you're willing to be appeased and come to an agreement. But if you're not willing to do so, just that the other choice that you have is worse, you know, it's the lesser of two evils, that's not called halachic mechila. Number 10.
Sorry, so what's the prohibition, the actual prohibition that you've transgressed?
Stealing. Stealing, not paying your workers, which is bal tolin. You'll see we have a list of 5 averis here on page 2. Okay? Now, number 10. You're a manager of a company. Can you set a trap? How many people said no to this? No to number 10? Why? Why do you think it's illegal to set such a trap? That's your great scholar. I'm impressed. Okay, he's right. You're not allowed to put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. In other words, you have no right to play God and deliberately tempt someone to violate an aver. Jeff, you were into this.
I said yes, if they're having robberies at the office.
Well, take a look. You're a manager of a company.
I remember Yeshiva many years ago. They set a trap because someone was stealing cash out of...
Whole different issue.
And they set it up so that
okay. cash... Jeff, cash, whole different issue. I'll tell you why. Because the poskim, the decisors, address the fine question, can you do things for educational reasons?
Not for educational. I'm trying to catch someone who was robbing.
So again, if it's in a yeshiva setting, it might have a different halacha because there are this is not about the $10 or the $100 that he was stealing.
He was already stealing.
Right, this is about education.
Our case is not somebody who was already...
No, but again, keep in mind that number 10 is that you're a manager of a company. Now, what would be the halakha if you own the company? I think, Jeff, you would try to lead me in that direction. If it's your personal company, or for example, let's say you're a homeowner, and you hire domestic help, the halakha might change in this case, if you have reason to suspect that some money is missing. But we're talking about a manager of a company, because our discussion is about employers. This you would not be allowed to do. But by the way, does the halakha recognize any sort of way of getting around this, in which you could set a trap?
Not towards him.
What you could do, listen to this, I'm not recommending that you do this, but you could take your wallet and declare it hefker. In other words, you could declare that it's ownerless. The question is how many people have to be there when you make that declaration. Okay, that itself is an issue. But it could be that if you decide that it's ownerless, then it's okay to do this. But as long as you retain full ownership over that wallet of money, you are in violation of Lifnei Evil Osite Misha. But you see, in a sense, Joe, you were thinking out of the box, which is good. You know, I wanted you to give me a knee-jerk response on what you believe is right or wrong in the society that we live in. But you went out of the box, and you thought, well, wait a minute, the Torah says, Lifnei Evil Osite Misha. Right, what are we up to now? Number 11, okay. Secrets of the profession. Okay, this is a complicated question, but basically, the answer to this question is no. You are not allowed to share secrets of the profession with your employer. In Jeff's case, that goes without saying. You know, those are client, you know, very, what was the word you used, confidential? No, there was another word you used, okay.
Proprietary
secrets. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about secrets of the profession. In other words, your first employer has developed a new strategy to reach his goal. You know, a marketing marketing methodology, for lack of a better word, that is really something brand new.
How do you operate without it? If you know a better way of going about something, how do you proceed to actually do the more foolish approach? You know somebody that has an optimal solution.
Right, in other words, what you could do is, you know, step by step, you try to do the best you can for your new employer. But to set it out on the table, formulate it in paragraphs, you know, sentences and paragraphs, this is the strategy that you wouldn't be allowed to do.
But it's like studying under a rabbi, and, you know, he has a unique system of teaching. And you know you're inspired, or is inspired by it.
Nothing here on this page applies to rabbis. Let's get that straight. Okay.
You know, he gets hired by a different synagogue,
right,
and he wants to implement this.
Okay.
He's not allowed.
All right. Let's go on to number 12 because I don't know. Anybody has to leave, just leave because I see we have 2 minutes left, and there's no way I can finish this in 2 minutes. Okay. What do you answer to this? I mean, we live in a free enterprise society. Does my employer have any control of my free time when I come home at night? Can he decide whether I take upon myself this very severe diet? And what's the answer to this question?
I would say it depends on whether it impacts on your employment.
Exactly. And this is a phenomenal breakthrough of halakha, and I don't think the legal systems have picked up on this yet. You know, a lot of things they got from our law and they've imitated, but not this one. This one says that your lifestyle has to be organized in a way that you can give maximum effort in what other word can I use besides effort and intellectual focus and concentration on your job, anything that will diminish your ability to be the best worker, the best employee that you possibly could do, unless it's a matter of health. That's a whole different discussion. Health. In other words, if the doctors are telling you, and that's a whole other sugi which I have here on page 2, which I don't know if we'll get to, that's a whole different question, because then your employer can make certain conditions about what you have to do for your health, and if it gets to the point in which your ability to function as a you know, as an employee is questioned, you know, then he might be able to fire you.
Am I allowed to fast on a sort of potatoes if that will degrade my...
Okay, that really is question number 14. As an employee, man, you take off time for prayers. And I know here in Zeifens it's not an issue, but as a matter of rule, what's the answer to this question? Yes or no?
Yes.
The answer is no. You have to organize your prayers during your free time. The halakha does not recognize, unless you get explicit permission from your employer, taking off time even for something as important as prayer. The Mishnah describes a guy who's working up on the tree and how, you know, how he's got to organize it in such a way that, you know, that he doesn't disturb his work.
He has to organize it. He's up the tree, and he has to say a Habi Neinu and a Shoshman Esra.
Okay, but he can't take time off from his work.
But he has to take
again, only if it doesn't take off time from his work.
Materiality.
Okay. We skipped question number 13. What's the answer to this one? Everybody gets right. Question number 13.
No.
The answer is no. Okay, that's great. Everybody knows the answer is no. Unless you have reason to believe that your employer would allow you to do so. Now, how do you go about doing that? The best way is to ask them. But there is an interesting halachic, you know, paragraph that I want to call to your attention that allows you to ask yourself the following question. You have to be very, you know, your discretion and your integrity has to be very strong for this. But ask yourself the following question. If your employer were present, would you be uncomfortable or embarrassed in his presence of using his photocopy machine, etc., etc.? You know, if you're going to draw, you know, grab the car keys of the company car in front of your employer, you know, you might be very, very uncomfortable by doing so without asking permission. But if on the other hand, he's sitting in his office and in front of him, you have no problem going over and using his copy machine. And again, I'm not talking about a situation where he assumes you're doing it for business purposes. That's a different... And you would not feel, you would not, you know, take a second blink about it. That usually is a very strong indication that in the context of your relationship with your employer, that's acceptable.
Is that,
and finally, number
materiality?
Yeah, materiality. Okay. I see you're really into that word. Okay. Question number 15. Okay, you're paid per hour. Okay? Okay, so somebody, I don't know if it was Yumo who yelled out the answer to this question. Is number 15 permissible, yes, or not permissible?
No.
Okay, this is done all the time in the business world. All the time. And there are thousands of examples and permutations of number 15. It is standard practice. Halakhically, it is prohibited. And I think it was Mo who threw out the word ribbis. This is a problem of taking ribbis, which means taking interest. What you're doing here is you're being paid less than what you should be paid because you're getting the money in advance. An advance for work that hasn't been done yet is considered a loan, according to halakha, and the laws of ribbis apply. Okay, how many people can quickly grade and calculate what they got? How many people got an 80 on this test?
But it wouldn't apply if your employer wasn't Jewish.
Oh, okay, that's an interesting question. Everything else would. Ribbis is an interesting question. But even ribbis with regard to a non-Jew is an issue. You know, it might be an issue not of ribbis per se, but it might be a different issue, which I don't want to discuss right now. How many people got 80%?
Number 7.
70%. Come on. You're just embarrassed, that's all. You don't want to wave the banner. Okay. Alright, so you probably just don't want to show off. But I'm sure most of you did very well on this exam. Now, in case you didn't, and I want to end this lovely, lovely lunch, thanking everyone for coming, and especially the Zeifmans for having me, with the following idea, which I take from Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik's book, Logic of the Heart, Logic of the Mind. And I'm going to give it 2 minutes for those who can give me the extra 2 minutes. Overtime. You've got to get paid overtime for this, right? There are two concepts in Jewish law that have to be fundamentally distinguished one from the other. One is called Mishpat, and the other is called Tzedek. And people tend to misunderstand or overlook the fundamental difference between the two. Mishpat, which are the rational laws that are predicated on what we call Tzelem Elokim, namely the right of every human being to dignity insofar as he's a creation of the divine being and his image is in divine being, and it matters not what color or what race, what religion, all of mankind. That fundamental principle of the dignity of man, which is called in halakha kvod habriyot, and it's a fundamental halakha, it overrides many different prohibitions, that is the yesod, that is the fundamental principle that underlies all of jurisprudence. And in that sense, when we answer these questions, what we're doing is, we are pumped up with the shall I call the secular jurisprudence of mishpat, and that's fine. But the Torah comes along with an entirely different principle, which is the pillar of all of what we call Jewish business ethics. And that is tzedek. Tzedek says that if you see someone who's drowning and you don't save him, that is tantamount to an act of murder. Within the context of mishpat, I don't know if there's any legal system that could condemn you as a criminal for not saving someone. The Torah says, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. And the interesting emphasis on the word kamocha. The Torah asks you to put yourself in the position of someone else. How is this employer going to be affected and impacted if I lure away one of his good men? Or if I'm an employee applying for a job and some other employee is going to get dismissed or won't be rehired because I presented my candidacy. And we are thinking from a system, if I could use a little French here, of laissez-faire and a free open market in the Western culture that is all predicated on mishpat, which as I said before is fine. What I'm not attuned to, because I live in this culture, is an entirely different system. A methodology of ethics that's predicated on duties and responsibilities, on protecting the rights of everyone, on tzedek. So as we approach Chag HaShavuot, the day of Matan Torah, I think the clock says I gotta go. I would like to wish everyone, not just the Chag Sameach, have a wonderful celebration, a wonderful holiday, but that we should all really appreciate what the Torah has given us. How mind-boggling the Torah is in its revolution, even in the year 2000 and what are we up to, 11, right? And it's just a revolution, and the older I get, the more I am absolutely stunned and overwhelmed by the revolution that I take a test like this and I get a 30 or a 40 because I'm pumped up with an intuitive sense of justice that's predicated on mishpat, which I would say is half the, or maybe a third of the picture of what the Torah is. May we all merit for living up to the standards of the Torah, both in mishpat, in terms of protecting the dignity of man in the image of God, and moreover, of tzedek, of understanding and appreciating the situation of our fellow man. And then we know that the end of days is closely, speedily coming in our time. We'll see Yerushalayim rebuilt, the Beit HaMikdash will be up there, the Jewish people will come en masse, as a people, with the banner of both Mishpat and Tzedek, b'mehera v'yameinu. Amen. Thank you so much.